However, Rojan wasn't real. But she was. And she was in Boston. And now she was going to die, too.
Here? Here?
Nuz was screaming again, unable to control herself.
Didn't she hear me? What this place is like? Why would she help you come here? Why would you do it?
There was a case in Tehran, Rojan said softly. Nuz fell into a stunned, paralyzed silence as the word sunk in. There was a case in Tehran. There was a case in Tehran. The words echoed in her mind over and over. There was a case in Tehran. It was everywhere now. Rojan looked down at her hands as Nuz swayed.
Nuz, she made me come.
Nuz heard what more her little sister meant to say. Because she wanted us to be together at the end. They both sat in silence in the darkness. Nuz reached out and took Rojan's hand and held it, and they stayed that way for a long time.
It had only just happened, the shadowlessness. Tehran Airport wasn't a madhouse yet. I got to London fairly easily. But Heathrow was not what I expected. I got stuck there in departures for almost 2 months. I couldn't find a flight out that was going to the United States. All the airlines had just stopped going there. I ate out of the vending machines. They were having to refill them twice a day, there were so many of us. Finally, I overheard someone saying Switzerland might be making U.S. flights, or was making flights to somewhere that was making U.S. flights. I managed to get to Zurich a week or two after that through Geneva. In Zurich, I found out the closest to Boston anyone was flying was Providence in Rhode Island.
Rojan finally continued.
I mean, the sign said Boston, but they told us they were really flying to Providence, because it was safer, because for some reason that city is almost empty of people now, and we'd have to make our own way from there. They were charging, I don't even know. I just kept throwing money at the counterperson out of Maman's savings until the lady gave me a ticket. Someone tried to rob me after that, but the airport staff beat him off. I went in the bathroom and put everything I had left in my bra and underwear then. Not like it was much.
What happened in Providence? Rojan shrugged.
The guy sitting next to me on the flight said he has a daughter here in Boston somewhere. I gave him the rest of what I had in exchange for a seat in his rental car. Well, the car he found in the rental car parking lot and hot-wired. We split up at the roadblock on the freeway just outside city limits.
Fuck, Nuz said.
He could have killed you or something. Yeah,
Rojan admitted.
I kind of can't believe I did it now. I just didn't know how else to get here.
They sat close, shoulders touching, as they ate the last of the bags of airplane peanuts the stewardess had generously gifted Rojan on the flight. Nuz's stomach ached ravenously. It was more food than she'd had in a long time.
So, what now? She asked.
They decided to head for New York, because that was the only place nearby that Rojan thought she hadn't seen come up on the news by the time she left Tehran. It struck them as a little funny, that of course it would be New York that would survive when the shit hit the fan.
Things weirder than this probably happen in New York every day,
Rojan joked as she held open the duffel bag, while Nuz packed it with what little they could take from the studio.
That's just movie New York, Nuz said.
But still, a part of her had hope. If anywhere in the United States was still functional, she couldn't help but believe it would be New York, too. Although, even if it wasn't, nothing was going to be worse than Boston.
Take off your necklaces, she added. They draw too much attention. They're Maman's, Rojan protested. I'm not just going to leave them here. Wrap them up and put them in the bag, then. You can't wear them.
Rojan obeyed, reaching for a pillowcase.
How long do you think it'll take on foot?
She asked.
If we really rush, 10 days, maybe?
Rojan nodded.
Good thing I packed soap.
Nuz smiled. She didn't have the heart to tell her sister that they weren't going to stop long enough at any point to allow washed fabric to dry, so there'd be no washing anyway. But they could survive each with a few pairs of underwear and the same bra. The bow was what she really needed to make sure they were safe, once they got out into the open country. They had to get out first, though. The roadblocks were still in place all over the city, held by police and emergency military personnel, the main streets all locked down. There was only one place left the government couldn't monitor very well. The water, Rojan grinned. It was how she'd avoided the roadblocks and reached Nuz in the first place, it turned out. After watching the man she'd shared a ride with, turned away by police in riot gear carrying huge machine guns, Rojan had decided she didn't want to press her luck, and started hunting for an unguarded street. But she couldn't find one. Sooner or later, she always ran into another roadblock or a roving patrol, blue and red lights dazzling the night. By accident, she found herself crouching behind a small overturned boat in a trash heap to hide from a passing cluster of police. And that's when she got the idea.
I dragged it up onto the bank where I came out and tried to hide it in the bushes, she said. I can show you where from the roof.
Once they were ready, they went up for the last time. Rojan walked to the far side of the roof and pointed. From Dorchester Street, it was just a few turns from the shore of Old Harbor, where she was sure the boat was hidden. They waited until 1:30 a.m. exactly, and then ran down the road as silently as they could in the pitch blackness. Sure enough, the little metal boat was there, stuffed into the shrubs. As they dragged it the last few yards to the shore, Nuz stepped into the icy water on accident with one foot and gasped in agony.
Nuz!
Rojan whispered panickedly.
Fuck, that's cold,
Nuz hissed.
Don't do that, I thought something was wrong. Something is wrong,
she snapped, but she shut up. Her sister was right, she could be freezing later. Rojan climbed into the boat and set her backpack and the duffel bag down, then put out a hand. Nuz slipped the bow over her shoulder and grabbed Rojan's palm. They rolled up their sleeves and paddled with their hands until their fingers were numb, because there were no oars. They drifted south, south, south. At some point in the darkness, they bumped into something floating. Nuz's first thought was that it was a body, but thank God it wasn't. It was just a piece of wood. When they finally found a shore that seemed far enough away, they crawled out of their own dinghy and crept between the carcasses of other half-sunk boats to the asphalt.
Heritage Drive,
Rojan read the street sign overhead softly. She looked at Nuz expectantly, waiting to hear if they'd gone far enough, if they were clear of Boston proper and the roadblocks.
I think we're okay,
Nuz muttered, dumbfounded. Somehow they'd paddled all the way to Quincy. How far was that? She tried to estimate. 5-6 miles?
Let's go slow.
She pulled the bow off her back and kept it ready. The streets were even more unnervingly still than from where they'd come. On the back wall of the next building, glowing under the flickering light of a roof security lamp, someone had graffitied a phrase in spray paint.
The one who gathers?
Rojan read softly. The name sent a chill through Nuz as her sister said it. Rojan reached out and touched the bottom drip of paint. It was long dry.
What on earth do you think it means?
Nuz shook her head slowly.
I have no idea, she said.
The One Who Gathers. Later, he came to have many names. The one with a middle but no beginning. The still mind. Patient R.A. Last, most important of all, the one who gathers. But in the beginning, he had no name at all. Once he had recovered enough to walk on his own, he was discharged from the hospital and moved to an assisted living facility to begin therapy with a specialist named Dr. Zadeh. This was years ago, some 3 months before that ominous May day when Hemu Joshi became the first man to lose his shadow. It was still early spring where he lived, in New Orleans. The sun rose late and set early in the gently crisp air there. Dr. Zade had come to him in the ICU on the first day, once the surgeons told him that his new patient was awake. Things were a blur then. Emptiness and fear. He couldn't lift his head or speak. The nurses were so harried that none of them realized he might want to know what was going on, let alone stop to tell him. But then Dr. Zade strode in with his starched lab coat, pen in hand, clipboard bursting with papers that must contain answers, and looked directly at him. Not at his vitals monitor, or his Frankenstein's monster scalp incision, but at him. The man felt a chill when he did it. Until that moment, the man hadn't been entirely sure he was alive at all. "I'm Dr. Zade," the doctor said. He spoke slowly and clearly. "You are in Ochsner Baptist Medical Center in New Orleans. You were involved in a car crash and suffered injuries. Some of them were very serious. You were in a coma for a week, but you're out of the woods now. Blink once if you understand."
"Yeah,"
he tried. His mind could not will his tongue. Finally, he gave up trying to speak and blinked once. It felt strange, as if only one eye had done it.
"Good,"
Dr. Zade said so encouragingly that he felt as if he'd accomplished something superhuman. "I'm going to ask you a few questions to better understand where we are with your recovery, and then I'll be able to give you more information. I want you to blink once to mean yes. Blink twice to mean no. Do you understand?" The man blinked once. "All right. First, are you in pain?" He stared at the ceiling. Slowly, things darkened and then brightened again twice in a row to mean no. Blink, blink. The drugs were good. In fact, they were so good that he almost wanted pain, only so he could know that the rest of him was still there on the bed.
"That's excellent, excellent. If you ever are in pain, I want you to blink very rapidly and continue until I notice. I'll be able to adjust your dosage immediately through your IV, and then find the surgeon on duty."
He blinked again once to indicate he understood. Dr. Zade took a slow, thoughtful breath. The man waited, curious. He couldn't imagine a single thing the doctor might want to know. He couldn't move or feel, or really even think. He seemed to just exist, nothing more.
"Do you know your name?"
Dr. Zade asked. "Oh," the man thought. "How strange."
"I need you to blink your answer to me,"
Dr. Zade reminded him gently.
"Do you know your name?"
"Blink, blink." "Thank you," Dr. Zade said in a practiced, neutral way. "Next question. Do you know to where you were going in your car when you had the accident?" The man looked at the walls, then the ceiling. His eyelids shuddered twice.
"Thank you. Do you know what city you grew up in?"
"Blink, blink."
"Thank you. Do you know where you went to school?"
He hadn't realized that such things as cities and schools existed. Then, as soon as Dr. Zade said the words, he could name the names of 100 of them. But not a single thing about himself, except that he had eyelids. Blink, blink. He waited for the next question. Blink, blink. Then the next. Blink, blink. Gradually, the ceiling grew hot, then wetly blurry. After he'd healed enough to be able to speak easily again, the man was told more of what had happened. In the rain, the car on the other side of the street had hydroplaned. He'd swerved to avoid a head-on collision and rolled his own vehicle down the side of a hill. It had been pouring so hard that night, the other driver didn't realize where the man's car had gone, the police report stated later. That it wasn't still on the dark road, traveling safely away in the other direction. It was another passing driver who noticed the headlights, like two stars in the black, but floating far too low to be in the sky. The man had been wearing a seatbelt, but something went wrong. His head still hit the windshield twice, fracturing his skull and one eye socket. Underneath the gauze patch on the left side of his face, there wouldn't be an eye. He was warned ahead of the bandage's removal. There had been nothing left there to save. The man listened to it all, waiting for any fragment of that terrifying crash to hit him again. But there was nothing. Dr. Zadeh spent a full week on his assessment. Brain scans, endless questions, more brain scans. He came in one day without his clipboard and sat on the edge of the man's white hospital bed. Total retrograde amnesia from the moment of the accident, Dr. Zadeh told him softly. He was born at 42 years old, a man with a middle, but no beginning. The assisted living facility worked mostly with Alzheimer's patients, but Dr. Zadeh managed to secure him a room there. He was one of the foremost neurologists in the country, the man learned from a fellow resident during a game of bingo. The hospital funded the facility for Dr. Zadeh in exchange for his research. The man became his star patient. Every morning, Dr. Zadeh gave him another test, or watched him practice something he'd learned in afternoon rehab the day before. The man grew skilled at reciting his personal information from the flashcards he'd made, but it was worth nothing. It was like learning the stale, meaningless biography of another person. He didn't want to know that he learned how to sail in high school. He wanted to singe his palms on the rough rope, breathe salty air. He wanted to feel if he had hated it or loved it. He should have clung to it, but he began to despise the name that was stated on his driver's license. It was not him. It was someone else, whom he was never allowed to know but also not allowed to forget. The other patients could feel it. Small parts of them inside understood. They began to call him anything but that name. The newcomer. The young one. The car crash lad. Most often, because it was not Alzheimer's that stole his past, but an accident, the amnesiac. The man, the amnesiac, loved them for it. Midway through the first week, Tilly, who at 103 years old had the revered title of oldest person in the facility, grinned at him as she was wheeled past. "You have a visitor today, Hennykins," she sang. "That's not your Hennykins," her nurse said gently. Hennykins was what she had called her youngest son, Henry, when he was a baby, when she remembered that she had a son. "Of course it is," she said. She eyed the nurse. "Who are you, though?" "You actually do have a visitor," Dr. Zadeh said, coming up behind him. A visitor? Someone had come to see him. The amnesiac stood speechless for a moment. It was a weightless, dizzy feeling. There was a person in the building who had known him from before. He didn't know which way to walk, so he started walking in circles until Dr. Zadeh led him hurriedly to one of the community rooms. "Take it easy," he said to the amnesiac kindly. "I'll be right outside if you need anything, all right?" Inside, a middle-aged woman with shoulder-length blonde hair jumped stiffly to her feet as the amnesiac closed the door behind himself. They both stood there, staring at each other. The amnesiac waited to feel the sensation that had been described to him as familiarity. A wave, a warm rush, a tingle, a lightning bolt. Nothing. "My God," the woman said. She put a hand over her mouth. "Oh, my eye," he realized. She must have known him when he'd had two. "Hello," he finally said back.
How are you feeling?
She asked. She paused before she sat back down on the couch. She was trying to decide whether or not she should hug him, the amnesiac deduced. They knew each other at least somewhat well then.
Very well, thank you, he replied.
He went to the armchair across from her. The next line came out automatically, more like a long musical phrase rather than distinct words. He had practiced it so many times.
I'm sure Dr. Zadeh told you, but I suffered neurological complications from my accident. Would you kindly tell me your name and how we know each other?
Of course. The woman shifted awkwardly and tucked her hair behind her ear. She was not pretty, the amnesiac decided. That was not the word he'd use.
My name is Charlotte. We went to college together.
Oh, yes, I have a bachelor's degree in history, he recited. He watched her for another long moment. The way she had answered made it seem like not the full truth. Not a lie, just not everything. The flashcard said he did not have a sister.
Did you also study history?
No, anthropology, she smiled. Very marketable.
Did you become an anthropologist?
Charlotte laughed. I'm in marketing. Data storage company.
She uncrossed her legs, crossed them again the other way.
You also didn't end up becoming a historian, she offered.
No, the amnesiac nodded. I went into law.
So were the facts. Yes, I know, she smiled. That excited him. Did I enjoy law school? How did I seem there? He asked.
Charlotte pressed her lips together.
Well, probably no one enjoys law school. It's a lot of studying, a lot of competition. But I think you enjoyed being a lawyer. You always seemed passionate when you talked about your job.
I'm glad, he said. That was very nice. He was happy he had liked being a lawyer.
Charlotte pushed her hair behind her ear again and clasped her hands. It struck him then. Fixed. That was the word he would use. He meant it in the best of ways. He felt as though he was spinning around the world, unanchored, careening all the time. But for Charlotte, the world spun around her. He could feel it. She did not move an inch. She was the most fixed thing he'd found so far.
I'm sorry I didn't come sooner, she blurted suddenly. This was as early as... I didn't know you'd been in an accident. Dr. Zadeh only called me last week. I guess it took them some time to work everything out off your driver's license. Who you were, everyone you might have known.
It's all right, he said. It really was. He hadn't known to miss her at all. Charlotte tried not to fidget. She was trying to look at him intently, without actually looking at him.
You can ask me anything, the amnesiac said. I don't mind.
So you remember nothing? Nothing from before you woke up in the hospital?
He shook his head. The first thing I remember is a nurse. She was leaning over me, trying to adjust my IV bag when my eyes opened.
But you remembered what an IV bag is?
Yes.
And how to talk?
Yes.
Could you walk? And dress and eat?
Well, at first everything was too broken for me to move. But once I healed, then yes.
Charlotte leaned back on the couch. Huh, she said to herself, mystified. Huh. The plate of cookies the facility staff had supplied for the visit sat untouched on the coffee table between them. He thought she might be about to cry. The amnesiac understood then what she wanted, why her answers were true but incomplete. The answer was no. No, no matter how long she sat there with him, he would not suddenly remember her on his own. Dr. Zadeh suddenly appeared in a burst of starched cotton and papers. He was the way he was when on the verge of another idea to test on the amnesiac, excited, moving at double speed. He seemed to have forgotten that they were mid-visit, that Charlotte was even there. "Sorry to interrupt," he managed at last, aiming a remote at the sleeping television in the corner of the room. He looked at the amnesiac as the screen blinked on. It was a festival of some kind, it seemed. At the center of all the colors, there was a man. A man with no shadow beneath him. "You have to see this." The amnesiac sat back and settled his elbows on the armrests. The chair was uncomfortably small. "Have I ever been on a plane before?" he asked. "Many times, I'm sure," Dr. Zadeh said as he fastened his own seatbelt. The amnesiac nodded, considering. The endless, low droning sound that filled the cabin of the plane made him feel like he was back in the hospital, hooked up to something. He wouldn't notice it after a while, Dr. Zadeh had promised. "Have I ever been to India before?" "That you have not," Dr. Zadeh replied. "The consulate didn't have any record of previous tourist visa applications under your name when I filed for this one." The amnesiac nodded. "Good. Good. This will be my first experience that hasn't actually already happened before." He smiled. "My first real memory." The flight was very long, but not as long as he had laid locked into his broken body in the hospital. The amnesiac sat comfortably. Any amount of time that was shorter than 3 weeks, he imagined he'd be able to tolerate quite easily. The plane sailed through the sky. He waited. They brought a meal around. It looked different from the food at the assisted living facility. He had never seen anything like it. Or perhaps he had. He took note to ask Charlotte about it at her next visit to see if she knew. "Lamb vindaloo," Dr. Zadeh pointed with his fork. "It's pretty good." "It is," the amnesiac agreed. "Is this Indian food?" "Not even close," Dr. Zadeh grinned. "This is airplane Indian food." An hour later, he had finished the tea they gave him. It was strange how it worked, retrograde amnesia. He knew what tea was, what India was. He knew the words for everything and all their meanings. He knew people spoke English in Pune, among other local dialects, as all schooling was taught in English in India. When he heard that Hemu Joshi played cricket, he realized he knew what cricket was, the rough idea of the game, even what the ball itself looked like. But he couldn't say for the life of him if he'd ever seen one with his own eyes. He wondered if it was like this for Hemu Joshi, too. Inside, he thrilled at the knowledge that he would meet him soon. Someone else who would understand what it was to be like himself. Or not himself, rather. He hoped it would work. That one of them might somehow teach the other something and unravel this mystery. He turned to Dr. Zadeh, but the doctor had fallen asleep while looking over the amnesiac's file again, leaving it open on his fold-out tray table. The amnesiac slid it to his own. He read the police account of the car crash again, and the paramedics' report. A collection of colorful ovals filled one page. "My brain," he thought. They seemed bright enough, he guessed. He didn't know which part meant that his memories had been knocked loose. His visitation log was also there. Charlotte's basic information. Name, phone number, relationship to patient. Ex-wife. Another fact to add to his collection. He had been married once. For a moment, it didn't mean anything. Then it did. "Charlotte," he said. He waited for the name to sound different now, but it didn't. Dr. Zadeh stirred. His eyes opened, beholding the man drowsily. They settled on the file open in front of him. His whole face sharpened, coming to life. The amnesiac pointed at the paper on top. "My ex-wife," he said again. He swallowed. "That was cruel of you. cruel. Dr. Zadeh looked down. I'm sorry, that wasn't the way I wanted you to find out. It wasn't good enough. Wasn't the way you wanted me to find out. How could you do that? How could you keep that from me? I had no idea she wouldn't tell you, he said back. When she didn't, I felt wrong betraying her confidence without speaking to her first. Her confidence? The amnesiac snapped. What about my confidence? I'm your patient. I'm the one you're supposed to help. I'm the one who doesn't know who he is. Even you know more than I do. Yes, you do. You knew who she was. You want me to get better? Why tell me some things and withhold others? Are you trying to curate me? What else do you know that I don't? Nothing. Shut up. Just shut up. Sir, the flight attendant cried. Please, it's all right, Dr. Zadeh said to her. Everything's under control. We're the medical case on your passenger register. We've been invited by the Prime Minister. The flight attendant narrowed her eyes. Dr. Zadeh was holding his passport out so she could verify his name, but she moved on with no more than a warning nod to him, ignoring the document. She had already known where they were sitting, the amnesiac realized. Everyone in the world knew who he was but him. He sucked in a breath so he could start shouting at Dr. Zadeh again as soon as the flight attendant was far enough away, but he glimpsed a sliver of the sky through the window as he shifted in his seat. The pure blue, the white. The clouds were so thick and rippled he couldn't see the ground. Above, empty. Beneath, endless silvered fog. He pressed his forehead to the cool safety glass. Enough. He trailed off. The clouds glided by below. They remembered nothing either. They drifted. They rained. How had he forgotten how beautiful they were? Somehow that hurt most of all. How is it possible to forget something like this? I can't think clearly and look at the clouds at the same time. I'm sorry, Dr. Zadeh murmured again. The plane relaxed into a curve of warm wind, a gentle, lingering dip, then out. The amnesiac realized that it was true. He barely noticed the drone of the engines anymore. Dr. Zadeh, he said softly. Yes? Do I have any children?
No,
Dr. Zadeh said, wounded. The amnesiac looked at him.
No, I promise you, no.
The days melted together in those early months at Elk Cliffs Resort. Even in the mountains, the heat was oppressive, humid and heavy, like a forest swamp. Do you remember that, Ori? The nights were only barely better. It was as if the breeze had stopped when all the shadows did, the air still and thick between the trees, the grass beneath us so warm that I could barely stand to touch you as we slept, as much as I wanted to feel the comfort of your arms around me, the solidness of your body. I began to dream about air conditioning, vivid hallucinations that made my skin prickle at the imagined chill. It almost felt like camping on the good days. Sleeping in the grass, blankets stretched into tents over our heads. Everyone had agreed it was temporary, just because of the heat. But after a while, I couldn't imagine moving back inside to the ballroom, even if there was frost on the ground. I think it was because we were all inside when we found out the shadowlessness had reached us. Being in there at night brought it all back too vividly. It was like the building itself remembered. After a month, things started to change. People began leaving. First, three slipped silently away in the night, too cowardly to say goodbye properly, and a fourth ended up sobbing hysterically by the fire as she tried to explain why she had to go. Libby, from Paul's side of the guest list. They had been on the high school swim team together, you told me later. Paul walked her all the way down the mountain, arm in arm, and came back crying. That night, around the fire, I heard more people whispering about when it might be their time to leave, too. When it might be too soon, just right, too late. Whether they lived near enough that it might be worth the risk, or too far. I watched you through the flames as you eavesdropped. Your and Paul's families were still in Portland, where you both had grown up, but all of mine were in Maryland, a survivable distance from Elk Cliffs. We'd seen reports about Baltimore on television before the signal had gone out. But if there was anything left, maybe they were left too. We could make it if we tried. But how to convince you? I'd been waiting for the right moment for weeks. You hadn't been ready to hear it. I felt like I had only one chance. And if I blew it, we'd never leave.
The second scouting party didn't come back,
Rabbi Levinson said when Paul and Emmanuel brought the idea of going up again. We'd sent the second party out 1 week after the electricity had gone down at the resort. There had been a fierce debate over forming a third one after that. Questions about whether we were sending the last survivors on Earth to their deaths, or possibly worse, alerting dangerous people, shadowed or shadowless, to our secret haven. But in the end, we had to do it. There was nothing. No television, no cell phone network, no internet, no radio. Or at least nothing that we could pick up. We had no other way to know what had happened down below. Rhino had led that group too, with one of the shotguns. They never came back. What else are we going to do? Someone argued. Rabbi Levinson persisted.
We don't know what's out there. We can't put any of us in such danger. It isn't fair to ask.
Then we'll only accept volunteers, like the first time.
The risk is too great. We're all we have left. So we should just stay up here forever?
Paul's voice was loud, on the border of threatening. Just weeks ago, he'd been smiling, tears of joy streaming down his face as he stood trembling with Emmanuel before the old man. To watch him face off against the rabbi now, red-eyed, was deeply unsettling. Some of us were trying to calm him down. Some of us were already shouting over him, demanding the third scouting party be formed.
We have to figure out why it's happening.
It's too dangerous.
We're going to die up here if we just wait then. What are we even waiting for?
The last group didn't come back. I'll go again, Marion said. Everyone fell silent. I looked down before she could make eye contact with me, ashamed that I wasn't brave enough to volunteer once more as well. The fire hissed as it ate a fresher twig of pine, then quieted again.
Me too,
Jaesuk said, and rose from the grass. On the other side of the flames, Lauren and Pierce also stood. They returned a week later. All had survived. I almost didn't believe it when I heard until I ran back to the courtyard and saw them cresting the summit, climbing over the low decorative stone wall. You, Paul, and Emmanuel were already there, pressing glasses of boiled river water into their hands. Jaesuk's wife was sobbing with joy, clinging to him. Did you see any signs of the second group? I asked after they'd finished hugging everyone. Jaesuk shook his head.
After the mountain. Just nothing.
We did bring back a bunch of first aid kits, though, from some of the abandoned stores, Marion said. And a jacket. We found one jacket. For later, I guess. She had her right arm tucked tightly against her, as though sprained or fractured somewhere. I took off your button-down that I had been wearing over my t-shirt for sun cover and wrapped it around her arm protectively, like a sling. Emmanuel needs to look at that, I said to her. Emmanuel was an obstetrician, but he was the closest thing we all had to a paramedic. It's an arm, not a baby. She smiled. Everyone burst out laughing. It seemed so funny. We were all just so relieved they'd made it back. There wasn't much more to the third team's report. They'd walked until they reached downtown Arlington and then gone through every home and shop, cautiously at first, then desperately, then hopelessly, searching for survivors. Buildings were burned or emptied out, windows smashed, doors crushed in. If there were any shadowed survivors in hiding, they must have been too afraid to make contact. The group was late back because they got lost a few times, because there inexplicably seemed to be streets through the city that hadn't been there before. At that early time, none of us understood how that could have been possible. The camp began to divide that afternoon, around the embers of the fire that was about to be lit for the evening. Half of us thought it was still too early and too dangerous, and the other half maintained that the worst of it had happened. If there was a time to go, that time was now. Sweat trickled down the small of my back and soaked into the waist of my pants. I watched you watch the rest of them argue, trying to determine which side you were on. And I watched Emmanuel. You and Paul's families were too far away to hope to reach, but Emmanuel was originally from Philadelphia, and Baltimore was on the way to Philadelphia. The four of us together, at least until Maryland, was the best plan we were ever going to get. I'd seen the way Emmanuel had watched the ones who were leaving lately. He was growing more and more ready to leave too, just like I was. Maybe I will talk to him and Paul, I thought. See if, together, the three of us could convince you that we should go with him. That was when we heard the screaming. I sat outside as you, Paul, Emmanuel, Rabbi Levinson, and Gabe talked quietly in the ballroom. I'd been invited, but I refused to participate. Instead, I watched the darkness, listened to the wood creaking as the trees shifted in the breeze. For once, I couldn't feel the sauna thick night air. I couldn't feel anything at all.
What do we do?
I heard you ask faintly through the closed glass doors. Marion's shadow had disappeared. The rest of the search party was all right so far, but the guests were too terrified to take any chances. They had been with Marion. Jacek was quarantined in room 382 of the resort, with his wife, Yeun, who refused to be separated from him, and Pierce and Lauren in rooms 390 and 392, respectively. They had to be persuaded at gunpoint. Marion went willingly into room 300. "Marion," I said in the moment before Gabe, a t-shirt wrapped around his face, pulled the door shut on her and locked it. Her eyes jerked up to mine for a single instant. There was something terrifying in them, a desperate ferocity to hang on to that name. "Marion," I said again, leaning against the smooth, silent wood on the outside of the door. I never told you what I did during those three long days, Ori, while the camp debated what to do. Not because I wanted to hide it from you, but because you would have convinced yourself that I had been contaminated, but been too afraid to say anything because you'd never be able to consign me to the same fate. I just didn't want you to worry. "What's your name?" I asked quietly through the door. "Marion," Marion replied, slightly muffled. I imagined her sitting in the same position as me. "Where are you?" "The honeymoon suite, I think," she said. I laughed, despite the grim situation. It came out like a snort. "Going okay so far, I guess," she continued after a few minutes. "It's only been a day, though." "A day and a night," I countered. "How are the others doing?" she asked hesitantly. I chewed my lip. "Max," she said. "I don't know," I admitted. "I haven't visited. Their rooms are all too close together. Easier to be seen." "Is there a guard?" "Sort of. Just Gabe at the main door. I keep coming in the back, through a door in the lounge. No one else wants to get too close, so no one's really checking the inside of the building." I imagined her mulling it over on her side of the door. wondering why I was just inches away from her then. So you don't know if any of them have lost their shadows yet? It was both a question and a wish that they were still all right. I left and found you after a short while, so you didn't notice I'd been gone. But I was back with her after dinner, saying I was going to help the cooking crew with the washing up at the river. Do you know what's a horrible dehumanizing thing to have to do, Ori? To wait for someone to squish food so flat that it can fit through the crack between the bottom of the door and the floor, and then eat it off the carpet like that, licking the dirty shoe-stained fibers. I don't know how to get you water, I said helplessly. It's okay, Marion murmured after a long time. There was... in the bathroom. I closed my eyes in shame. She was having to drink from the toilet. We sat for what seemed like an hour in silence. What's your name? I said at last. I still remember Max, she said. She shifted. I heard her try to swallow and barely succeed, the dry sides of her throat sticking together. Do you think they're hoping to starve or dehydrate us to death? Is that the plan? I don't know, I answered. I think everyone's just too afraid that if they open the doors, you'll all run out and touch them or something, that you wouldn't cooperate and stay back. We're just trying to figure out what to do. Marion sighed, long and slow. Did you see me when we all first realized it had happened? I didn't, I said. I wasn't there. I heard her change position again on her side of the carpet. I realized that I couldn't see anything shift through the tiny gap under the door. It was so strange. My senses went numb from the confusion. It was like hearing one person say something while watching someone else move her lips. Oh, Marion finally said. What? What's this place called? She asked. I forgot. By the end of the next day, Marion wasn't talking much, weak from the dehydration. Whatever was in the porcelain bowl must have been long finished. And it was just so hot, without the air conditioning and being unable to open the safety catches on the windows. The day was bright, but when I crept into the empty hall, I was dripping wet. She was dying of thirst, and it was raining, but only outside her side of the building. I tried to stop thinking about what it might mean. I tried not to think about it at all. And I didn't tell anyone. I couldn't. They'd know I was sneaking in. I just wanted to fix her arm. That was the only thing about it all that could be fixed. I felt like it was my fault for not saving her. I was the reason Marion was here. I had been her friend. I had introduced her to Paul and Emmanuel once you and I had gotten serious, trying to combine our social circles. I had begged her to take the flight, to see all of us again after so many years. But I didn't know how to bring her shadow back or stop her from forgetting. The room was starting to smell faintly of shit, from whatever corner she was relieving herself in. When she did speak, it was a strange mix of piercing detail and huge, vague swaths. She recalled one of her two names, her first, but not her last. She remembered that we were at a wedding, but not where it was or who had gotten married, that I was her friend, but not what my name was. Why am I in here? She asked again for the third time. You're sick, was all I could think of to say. Sick, she repeated. I heard her shift again, saw nothing move on the floor. I don't feel well, I didn't tell her it was because she was dehydrating to death. They promised to make a decision by the morning. I offered. To figure something out by the third day.
It's been 2 days?
She asked. I tried to remember how it was reported to have been with Himujoshi. She seemed to be forgetting much faster than he had. The last time I visited her, at dawn on the third day, I was surprised to hear her already awake.
Do I know you?
She asked as I sat down. Yes, I said.
Okay,
she said. We both waited a while, until it felt normal for me to be sitting there again. My name is Max, I finally told her.
Max,
she said to herself, as if rolling the word around in her mouth. I felt cold as I sat there. She really didn't remember me at all. Marion, I scooted closer and dropped my voice.
What is a Marion?
We sat in silence for a long time. What's it like to forget everything? I asked softly. Are you afraid? She settled against the door.
Maybe I was,
she said.
But now I'm not. Now it just feels simple. It probably seems terrible, but it's not. At first I was angry. But every day I forget more. Maybe I'll forget so much I won't remember what I've lost. Or that I've lost anything at all. You can't miss what you don't know you had, can you?
Do you remember Hallie? I wanted to ask her. Do you remember your daughter? Your husband? Do you know what karma is? I finally whispered.
No,
she answered. When I left her and sneaked back outside through the rear lounge door, the sun was so strong it felt like the grass was curling under my shoes. I came around the corner and tried to look like I'd been strolling through the trees this whole time. When I reached the patchwork lawn of blankets, I saw you walking toward me. Thank God. I started to jog. If you were outside, instead of in the ballroom, that could only mean one thing. You all had figured something out. You were going to do something to help Marion and the rest of the third scouting party. Your shoulders jumped in surprise when you saw me, and I started to smile with relief, but then I saw the look in your eyes. I argued, but no one listened. Not even you. It had taken your group 3 days to decide what to do. But actually, I think all of you had known what was going to happen from the first moment. It just took you 3 days to rationalize it into something that would let us face one another every morning thereafter.
The One Who Gathers. The nurse leaned down again, holding the coffee pot out to him. No, thank you. The amnesiac said. I will have more, though, Dr. Zade cut in and raised his mug. He rubbed his face slowly as if trying to stretch it into a different shape. Jet lag, he smiled, and she nodded sympathetically as she refilled his drink. Overhead, the central air conditioning clicked on, blasting the waiting room with icy wind. When they'd stepped off the plane, the air in Pune had been as warm and thickly humid as it was at home in New Orleans, but everywhere they'd gone since, the private government car sent to retrieve them, their 5-star hotel, the car again to bring them to Maharashtra Regional Hospital, the now quarantined psychiatric ward, was almost arctic cold. He just wanted to go outside and look. All the colors, the movement. Pune was so much more alive than the antiseptic, manicured courtyard of his assisted living facility. Did I like coffee? The amnesiac asked when the nurse had moved away. I don't know. That wasn't information I could find from your records or emails. The amnesiac took another testing sip of the steaming dark liquid. Maybe Charlotte will be able to tell you? Dr. Zade tried tentatively. The amnesiac shrugged. He would ask her when they were back, but he didn't know if it mattered. For this new him, the taste made his tongue curl. I don't like it now, he said. Would that mean I didn't like it before? Sometimes, Dr. Zade nodded. It can. He most likely did not like coffee before. He would add this fact to his flashcards. Plenty of people don't like it, Dr. Zade continued, in case he was feeling excluded from some societal ritual. They just drink it so as not to feel like a truck ran over them. He took another sip. Like right now. I feel fine, the amnesiac replied. Now that's weird, he said. They laughed. The amnesiac couldn't stay angry with him. He had no one else in the whole world. Why me? He finally asked. Dr. Zade glanced up. Why was I chosen to meet Heimu Joshi? Well, it was mostly my doing, Dr. Zade grinned sheepishly. When I saw the first videos of Heimu after he began experiencing memory loss, I called the Indian Psychiatric Society, explained who I was, emailed copies of my articles, my research on you. They eventually managed to put me all the way through to the team here. I told them about my idea. I know that, the amnesiac said. I meant, there must be hundreds of retrograde amnesia cases in India from which they could have chosen. Why fly us out here? Because you forgot so much, he answered. Everything, really. Most RA cases aren't as complete as yours, and it happened at almost the same time as Heimu Joshi's incident. You're both still experiencing the effects of your diagnoses on your lives, learning how to cope with the loss. You were the closest match to him that we could find. Do you really think I can help him? I think you have a better shot at understanding him than any of us do, he said. After a moment, he put his hand on the amnesiac's shoulder. Just speak with him. That's all. Don't worry about the results, okay? The amnesiac nodded. Excuse me, we're ready for you now, a voice called. They turned from their seats to see an older woman in purple scrubs, perhaps 60 or so, her long silver braid shining against the warm brown of her skin. David Zade, Dr. Zade said, extending his hand as he went over to her. This is... He paused, grasping for a way to explain the amnesiac's aversion to his legal name. My patient. He prefers to be addressed by description rather than by what he was named prior to the accident. The visitor, in this situation, perhaps, or any relevant equivalent. A method of your rehabilitation? She asked Dr. Zade. For him, I suppose, yes, he said thoughtfully. The woman nodded. Dr. Zade, visitor? I'm Dr. Avantakar, she said. Lead researcher for Mr. Joshi's team. The amnesiac put out his hand to her as well. Her grip was firm and excited, he thought. We've informed him you're coming, she continued as the two of them followed her down the hall. He remembered 20 minutes ago when I checked. An aide got the tail end of her sentence as they entered a small control room and shook her head. Oh, Dr. Avantakar sighed. Never mind. Thank you again for this invitation, Dr. Zade said. To be able to help with this, even in a small way, it's an honor. Well, let's hope it does help, Dr. Avantakar replied. I don't have to tell you. I mean, I'm sure you've been following the news. Nothing's working, the amnesiac finished for her. I've just... She paused, words failing her. I've just never seen anything like it. Okay, we're all set. The patient is inside. Another aide interrupted softly. Right, Dr. Avantakar straightened up. Okay, let's take you in there and introduce you,
and then once you're both comfortable, we'll hook up the sensors so we can get some data. See if you two can maybe inspire each other into anything, really.
The amnesiac didn't know what to expect. He braced as Dr. Avanthakar went to the side door into the observation room and pulled it open.
Oh.
He blinked, surprised. He walked in. It didn't look like a hospital or a rehabilitation center or a patient observation room at all. It looked